And FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
We are diverse, independent, and yours. CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
We are not only endangering Palestinians, but we're also very much, I think, endangering Israeli and other Jews, because I believe that ultimately the safety of Israeli Jews and the safety of Palestinians is intimately interconnected. It is just utterly foolish, it seems to me, to believe that you can inflict terrible, terrible, catastrophic violence on people again and again and again and not be endangering yourselves. To me, that is one of the lessons of October 7th. That is not to justify October 7th. It's simply to say that, the way you act to others is also likely to influence the way other people act to you. It's the most basic of human reality.
That's Peter Beinart. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Peter Beinart on protest, Zionism, and Gaza. On December 5th, Amnesty International determined that it has found sufficient basis to conclude that the government of Israel has committed and is continuing to commit genocide against Palestinians in the occupied Gaza Strip. In the landmark report, You Feel Like You Are Subhuman, Israel's Genocide Against Palestinians in Gaza, Amnesty International documents how, during its military offensive launched in the wake of the deadly Hamas-led attacks in southern Israel on October 7, 2023, Israeli forces have carried out acts prohibited under the Genocide Convention, with the specific intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza, unquote. The report goes on to say, quote, by continuing to supply weapons to the Israeli government, the U.S. government is violating its obligation to prevent and punish genocide and is at serious risk of becoming complicit in genocide. Our guest today is Peter Beinart. He's professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York. He's a contributing opinion editor at the New York Times, and he's editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. He's the author of The Crisis of Zionism and Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. Peter Beinart spoke at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-November. The moderator, Michelle Mushabek, begins.
I would like to hear your thoughts about the student and pro-Palestine solidarity movement. And as the U.S. continues its unqualified support for Israel, how do we assess the success of these movements?
I guess I just wanted to start by saying that I feel like when I speak on this subject, it's important for me to acknowledge that I know that there are going to be people in this room and maybe people who are listening or not in this room who are going to disagree with certain things that I say. And when I see that there are people in an audience who disagree with me from whatever perspective, I always feel a deep sense of gratitude that they've come to listen, because I think one of the things that so often happens on this subject and other subjects is people only go to listen to those that they agree with. One of my favorite quotes from Jewish texts is from Pirkei Avot, who is wise, the one who learns from all people. So I always feel like if you have gone for a long distance to try to learn from someone that you actually are inclined to disagree with, you are kind of showing a wisdom that actually is a model for all of us, including myself. I think that this movement that has grown so much over the last year has the potential to be one of the great moral movements of the last century. You know, it has some of the same features that I think you could see in the anti-Vietnam War movement or the movement, the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. There was a basic sense that the United States government was using its money, and in this case its weaponry, to do things that fundamentally violate norms of freedom and human dignity, and that while some of the people in that movement have a particular personal or familial ancestral relationship to that place, some of them Palestinian or other people from the Middle East, significant number of them also Jews who have their own personal connection, that what gives the movement its potential power is the fact that there's a moral impetus that does not require any personal connection. Just as like one didn't have to have any personal connection to the people of Vietnam. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of my heroes, said that in 1967 that he could not. Rabbi Heschel was came from a Polish Hasidic family. He literally could culturally and geographically not have been further away from Vietnam than you could imagine. And yet he said in 1967 that he could not open a siddur, he could not open a prayer book without seeing the images of children being napalmed from American weapons. And I think this movement has that capacity to bring people from every possible different background, especially people who in their own families and experiences have a history of oppression and of their dignity and humanity not respected, but not even only them as well, right? And I think that's extremely powerful.
The protests in and of themselves, they have garnered so much backlash.
Yes.
Even congressional hearings, yes, that, yes, resulted in the resignation, yes, of two major,
yes,
presidents of major universities. The universities framed these protests as anti-Semitic,
right,
you,
right,
know, and they used extreme measures,
right,
as they brought in riot,
right,
police and so on and,
right,
so forth. How, in your view, have definitions of constitutionality, guaranteed free speech, been redrawn by academia and higher education?
Yeah.
And what has been the impact of the Palestinian exception?
I think we don't fully yet know what the impact will be. We're going to see now that the repression and the silencing that happened by universities and with the encouragement of politicians that was allowed under the Biden administration will now dramatically increase under the Trump administration. And many Democrats will not actually have the moral standing to really oppose it, right? Because they were complicit in it when Democrats were in power. And I also think that, you know, if you look at the anti-BDS legislation, right, legislation to basically say, if you support boycotting Israel, you can't be a contractor for state government, right? There was this woman in Texas who was a special education teacher. She was not allowed to work in the Texas public schools. That then became a template for other groups. So fossil fuel companies decided, oh, this is great, right? We can now also say that if you're going to boycott ExxonMobil, you shouldn't be able to teach in the Texas public schools as well. The Palestine exception, of course, is wrong in and of itself. It's also dangerous because it becomes a model for something else. So if you say that pro-Palestinian protesters can't protest in front of the president's office because it's too disruptive for students and other people who want to work. But once you've set that idea that basically you can't be too disruptive, you can't make too much noise, you can't have more than 25 people or whatever, then lots of people will then use that exception to broaden it to repress speech as well. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that there was a period of time when it was people on the right who were fashioning themselves as the great proponents of free speech, especially on campus. They were saying, don't be snowflakes. The whole point of going to university is that it's supposed to be intellectually, you know, rough and tumble, and you're going to hear things that are challenging to you, but that's good. That's what education is about. And you know what? I think they were right. I think part of going to a university is you're raised with certain views, certain beliefs, and those are challenged. And ideally, they're challenged in a polite and decent and civil way. Sometimes people are jerks about it. Sometimes people challenge them are not particularly nice about it. But as long as they're not physically threatening you, you know, intimidating your, endangering your safety, you should see this as an opportunity to learn. Even if you don't necessarily agree, you're exposed to different points of view than the ones you were raised with. And that's the whole point of going away to university. It's so sad to me that people who could see that and make that argument, sometimes eloquently, when it came to other groups, that when it came to us, to the Jewish community, then all of a sudden the kind of rules change, and that basically then you have this unwillingness to make any distinction between lack of safety and lack of comfort. That Jewish students have an absolute right to be safe on, include Zionist Jewish students have an absolute right to be safe on campus, but no student has the right on campus to be made intellectually comfortable. To be made intellectually uncomfortable, morally uncomfortable, is the point of a university. And if a university tries to stop that from happening, then I think it's violating its own mission.
The incoming Trump administration, their strategy to suppress Palestinian solidarity movement is clear. Weaponizing Islamophobia and accusations of anti-Semitism to silence criticism of U.S. support of the Israeli state and create a chilling impact on potential future activism. Trump would not hesitate to deploy the military, and he regularly spoke about the enemy from within. So with Republicans having a majority control of the House as well as the presidency and the Senate and the courts, are we likely to see an intensification of the student protests, more silencing of Palestinian voices, more crackdown, so on and so forth?
Yes.
Is it going to make our resistance and organizing harder?
I think it will. Yes, absolutely. You know, to me, there's a very painful irony in the fact that this is being done, so much of it is being done in the name of Jewish safety. And sometimes I feel like some of these people who are speaking in the name of Jewish safety, you know, at least Stefanik or whatever, they're putting Jews forward, right? Because what they really can't say is that they dislike these movements on campus because they feel like they threaten white people. Because that's harder to say. They say that they threaten Jews, right? But the reality is that actually the politics of Elise Stefanik and Donald Trump and Matt Gaetz and all these people are much more dangerous to Jews than a kind of pro-Palestinian protest movement. Again, which is not to say I agree with every single slogan or statement that is made. There's some that I disagree with. But the basic question is that American Jews and Jews in most diaspora societies, we have really staked our safety and the safety of our children on the principle of equality under the law. Right? I mean, obviously, we live in societies that are profoundly unequal. But we have recognized, most of us, that as a group that has historically been singled out for discrimination, that the principle of equality under the law, the principle that Jews in Europe yearned for, and for the most part were never able to achieve in the 19th and then the first half of the 20th century, is the best bet for a group of people like Jews to be safe. And that the closer America moves to that, right, that's why many Jews, not all, but many Jews saw in a kind of enlightened self-interest, the reason that civil rights movement was in their interest, because they saw that since Black Americans were kind of the other in America par excellence, if they moved towards equality under the law, then Jews would benefit enormously from that larger cultural shift and ideology, which they did massively. It was in that period in the 60s that the law firms and country clubs that used to exclude Jews and even universities, have to quote, it's got rid of those things, right? And now you have this terrible irony that you have an Israeli government in partnership with kind of establishment Jewish organizations, where essentially, whether they're admitting it or not, are basically in support of an ethno-nationalist project, a support of white Christian supremacy, or maybe they would call it white Judeo-Christian supremacy, which is just a way of saying it, not for the Muslims, because it's those people who are fervently supportive of Israel. And it's not surprising that those people like Stefanik and Gaetz and those people are fervently supportive of Israel, because they see Israel's ethno-nationalism as a model for the ethno-nationalism they see in the United States. Their vision of the world is that every country should be dominated by one tribe. Right? And it's also the vision that Narendra Modi has in India as well, or Viktor Orban has in Hungary, right? And I think that's very dangerous even for the Jews in Israel. I think it's terribly dangerous for Jews in Israel, but it's certainly dangerous for Jews around the world. Because if one thing is clear, if every country is dominated by one tribe, our tribe is not going to be the one that's dominating the United States, right? We are a small minority here, quite visible, and the people who demonize other vulnerable groups in the United States, right, very frequently get around to Jews sooner or later, right? The idea that you're going to make a separate peace with white Christian supremacists and you're going to say, great, go after the Muslims, go after the Mexicans, go after the LGBT folks, you like us, right? That generally does not work out very well. The polling shows pretty clearly that one of the best indicators of whether someone doesn't like Jews is whether they don't like immigrants, they don't like trans people, they don't like Muslims. The Pittsburgh shooter did not start out being obsessed with Jews. He got obsessed with these immigrant caravans that were supposedly invading America from Central America. And then he noticed that the synagogue down the road was partnering with a Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society to do a refugee Shabbat, and he decided that Soros was behind the whole thing, and then he ended up committing an act of mass murder against the synagogue, right? So this is how this white Christian supremacism works. And the fact that you have Jewish organizations that are essentially supporting this effort and supporting people who want to move America in an ethno-nationalist direction is not just morally wrong, it's extremely dangerous for us.
Zionism is a settler colonial ideology of Jewish supremacy that privileges one people over another. A decade or so ago, you didn't have a problem with that. And what I'd like to know is what caused this conversion, this transformation? Did you go to the West Bank? Did you meet Palestinian friends? Did you read Ilan Pappe, Edward Said, Shlomo Sand, Avi Schleim, Rashid Khalidi, and any of the others? Yeah. What happened there?
Well, I'll tell you my views as they are now. My views have, as you know, have changed, and so they could change again. I think that the first thing that's worth acknowledging is that Zionism, before the creation of Israel as a Jewish state, had more variety and more fluidity than it did once Israel was created. So there were people who... Noam Chomsky, at one point, was part of a Zionist youth movement. He was, as a very young man, in a Zionist movement, which passionately opposed the creation of a Jewish state, right? Martin Buber defined himself as a cultural Zionist. He testified against partition and against the creation of a Jewish state, right? So Zionism, at a certain point, meant something broader. There were Zionists who believed in the importance of a Jewish thriving culture in Palestine, but opposed a Jewish state. That Zionism, of course, was never the dominant Zionism, and it's not the Zionism that Israel has been enacting since 1948. But in some ways, I think that lost cultural Zionism, which believed in a binational state, which was where Said ended up his life after giving up on the idea of two states, is an important thing to remember, especially for Jews. And it's the reason I think it's important to remember that there were those figures is so much often in the mainstream Jewish conversation, the assumption is if you oppose a Jewish state, a state that privileges Jews over Palestinians, it means that you don't believe that Jews should be allowed to live in this territory, or your view is that essentially it's just taken for granted that it would be impossible for Jews to live and thrive in this territory unless they had a state in which they had legal supremacy. And I think it's important to recognize that there is a tradition of Jewish thinking, even of people who called themselves Zionists, who fundamentally rejected that and who actually believed that Jewish culture in that land would be much more successful over the long term if it was not linked to a state project that oppressed Palestinians. I think that you are right. I agree with you that Zionism is a settler colonial movement that has disenfranchised and destroyed Palestinian society and continues to do that to this day in horrifying ways. I also think that Zionism, even state Zionism, is not only that. I think it also led to the creation of a state that gave people coming out of the Holocaust a refuge and even an experience of liberation. And I don't think those two things are in conflict, right? I mean, if one thinks about, it's a different historical example, but if one thinks about another settler colonial project, the settler colonial project of Liberia, for instance. Liberia was a state founded by enslaved Black Americans who returned to West Africa and would have seen Liberia as a kind of refuge. It was also a settler colonial project that brutally dispossessed the native people in West Africa, right? And this is why when people say Zionism can't be settler colonialism because Jews have deep roots in what we call Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, right? It clearly can't, right? The people of Liberia who set up a settler colonial project in Liberia had very deep roots, in fact, had been in West Africa much more recently. They still enacted a settler colonial project, talking about modernity, modernization, talking about progress, practicing dispossession, which is what settler colonial movements do. So my own views evolved, I would say, primarily more than anything else in response to spending time in the West Bank with Palestinians. It took me way too long in my life. It was not really until my early 30s even though I had been to Israel, like many, you know, many Jews had as a kid many times, I had had very little interaction with Palestinians. And my understanding of Israel was very much, I think, cloistered and limited by not being able to, as Said famously said, see Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. I tended to think about it primarily through this, from the standpoint of people like my grandmother, who was born in Egypt, who then lived in the Belgian Congo, then lived in South Africa, and always felt to her, given the precarity of her life, that a Jewish state provided her with a sense of safety and security. And I knew that Israel was doing things that were not good. But the problem is that knowing that something is happening that's not good in a vague, abstract way doesn't really touch your heart. You need to be able to associate it with actual people who you see, who you meet, who you talk to, and to see what happens to them. And so when I first began to do that, I knew that it was going to be the beginning of a process. I didn't know where it would lead ultimately. I didn't know it would ultimately lead here. But I knew it was going to be a process in which I was going to have to rethink a lot of things. And initially, I thought, again, it was also the times I thought, well, the partition between a Jewish and Palestinian state would be the most practical response to this fundamental problem. Palestinians won't have an occupying army in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem anymore. But over time, it became clear to me, first of all, clear to other people long before me, but eventually to me as well, that partition was not possible. And also that partition didn't answer some more fundamental questions, which is to say, if the point of partition is to maintain a Jewish state, well, then partition cannot allow for Palestinian refugee return because that imperils Israel's demographic majority. And as I began to think about it, it just didn't seem to me that I had any moral rationale for arguing that people who were born in Safed or in Haifa or in Jaffa or in Lod or wherever and had been expelled or didn't have the right to return. And then people would say, often I heard people would say, yeah, but, you know, those, their children or grandchildren are not original refugees. They weren't born in those places themselves. And I would think, wait a second, we're the group of people who said we have the right to return after 2,000 years to a place that most of us have never lived. So we are the last people on earth who should be telling people that they have to give up on the right to return to a place because it was 75 years is nothing, right? I mean, if, you know, anyone has experienced Tisha B'Av in the Jewish calendar, right? We're talking about things that happened, happened 2,000 years, and we talk about it in the first person. So again, it just didn't make any sense to me. And so then I just became impossible to reconcile this idea of a Jewish state, a state that privileges Jews, with the idea that Palestinians have a right to return and that Palestinian citizens have the right to be treated equally, which you can't be treated equally in a state that gives legal privileges to people of another, you know, ethno-religious group any more than I could be treated equally in America if it was a Christian state. And so that's what ultimately led me to the position I have now, which is I believe in an equal binational state.
Your grandmother means a lot to you. Mm-hmm. And you dedicate the new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, you dedicated to her memory. In your dedication, you say that she disagreed with arguments in this book. You also start your book with a note to my former friend, who believes that your opposition to the war on Gaza constitutes a betrayal of your people. How do you talk to your grandmother, your family members, your friends, and those who can't see the injustice of apartheid, ethnic cleansing, oppression, dehumanization, so on and so forth? How do you convince them that this is not the path to Jewish safety?
Well, I mean, I wrote the book precisely because I was so struggling so much with that. I mean, with my grandmother's memory, but also with so many people around me who are very, very important to me, very precious to me, who in so many other ways in which they aspects of their lives I respect and admire so deeply. You know, it's one thing when you see someone who you think, this is not such a great person. They're not a thoughtful person. They're kind of crude. So they don't care about the destruction of an entire society in Gaza, that most of the universities are destroyed, most of the hospitals are destroyed, most of the agriculture is destroyed, most of the buildings are destroyed, because that's the kind of person they are. They just have no human sensitivity. They don't go through life that way. But I'm thinking about people who are not that way at all, people who in other aspects of their lives are very, very thoughtful, very, very decent, very conscious of the way they are in the world. And for me, the most, and in a way, my grandmother, although she was not an intellectual, she was someone who had like very deep generosity of spirit and empathy for people and deep love, deep, deep love of the Jewish people, deep sense of this idea that that she thought of Jews as an extended family and that who was obligated to one another. And yet I really struggled, especially over the last year, with the way in which this sense of solidarity, this language of solidarity and mutual obligation, which I really believe in, then gets turned through a nationalist or ethno-nationalist project into gets weaponized in ways that are extremely, extremely dangerous and can allow even really good and decent, thoughtful people to basically just shut down and deploy a series of what seem to me really transparent talking points in order to not have to experience and feel and respond to what's being done in their and in our name.
You're listening to Peter Beinart on Protest Zionism and Gaza. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
My book was kind of an effort to try to speak to those people and to say, listen, we're losing something of ourselves in this. We're not only endangering Palestinians, but we're also very much, I think, endangering Israeli and other Jews, because I believe that ultimately the safety of Israeli Jews and the safety of Palestinians is intimately interconnected. It is just utterly foolish, it seems to me, to believe that you can inflict terrible, terrible, catastrophic violence on people again and again and again and not be endangering yourselves. To me, that is one of the lessons of October 7th. That is not to justify October 7th. It's simply to say that the way you act to others is also likely to influence the way other people act to you. It's the most basic of human realities. And part of what my book tries to do in one of the chapters is to look at the way in which Israel has responded when Palestinians have fought for their freedom in ways that do not take Israeli civilian life. How have Israel and the United States government and an organized American Jewish community responded when Palestinians have gone to international institutions like the UN and the International Criminal Court, when they've launched boycotts, when they marched nonviolently in 2018 to the borders, to the fence of Gaza? How do they even respond when the Palestinian Authority adopted a strategy of appeasement, of essentially of a kind of collaboration? I mean, it's an astonishing thing that the PA did, right? I mean, it basically said, we're going to work with the Israeli government to make sure that there is not violent resistance in the West Bank in the hopes that you will then trust us enough to have a state. Even that, basically, they got nothing for. And so in those conditions, those actions of shutting down that kind of resistance make it more likely you're going to get the kind of resistance that you got on October 7th.
It was one of the main reasons why Hamas was elected in 2006 is exactly because of that. Because the Palestinian people did not see any benefits.
I mean, there were people like Saeed who saw that Oslo, from the beginning, he saw Oslo is a trap, it's a Palestinian Versailles. But the polling data that I looked at showed that there was a period of time in the beginning of Oslo in which there was a lot of optimism about Oslo among Palestinians, and there was support, and that was the point in which support for violent resistance was at its lowest. But certainly by Netanyahu's election, it is completely cratered, because you see that settlement growth is continuing, and this creates the opportunity for people to say, Your strategy is not working. I had a Palestinian friend from Gaza who has told me about conversations he had with people he grew up with who were in Hamas. And they said to me again and again, how well have your efforts worked? Have you gotten anything for us?
You quote Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and he said about Judaism is about the universality of justice. In your view, do you think Judaism has been hijacked by Zionism? And without Judaism, Zionism would not be able to survive?
Zionism always had a strange relationship with Judaism in the sense that it was in some ways a rebellion against Judaism, because the kind of normative understanding of Jewish law was that God had decided to exile the Jewish people from the land of Israel. And when God decided to bring a Messiah and transform the world and bring the Jews back, God would do it in God's time. And the role of Jews